Good morning and welcome to today's edition of Times the Brief, brought to you by Spoken Layer. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day.
The government on Saturday suspended enforcement of President Donald Trump's refugee and immigration ban and scurried to appeal a judge's order, plunging the new administration into a crisis that has challenged Trump's authority and ability to fulfill campaign promises. The stand-down, a day after a federal judge in Washington state temporarily blocked the ban, marked an extraordinary setback for the White House. Only a week ago, the president had acted to suspend America's refugee program and halt immigration to the U.S. from seven Muslim-majority countries that the government said raises terrorism concerns. As the White House worked to reinstate the ban, Trump mocked U.S. District Judge James Robart, appointed by President George W. Bush, as a so-called judge whose ridiculous ruling will be overturned. Trump's direct attack recalled his diatribes during the campaign against a federal judge of Mexican heritage who was overseeing a Trump University case. Justice Department lawyers could be called upon to answer for his words as the travel ban case reaches the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. The order had caused unending confusion for many foreigners trying to reach the United States, prompted protests across the United States, and led to multiple court challenges. Demonstrations took place outside the White House, in New York, and elsewhere. One was planned later Saturday near the estate in Palm Beach, Florida, where Trump was spending the weekend and where the American Red Cross scheduled its annual fundraising gala. Robart's ruling, which the Justice Department promised to challenge, led federal agencies to unwind enforcement of Trump's executive order. The State Department, after initially saying that as many as 60,000 foreigners from Iraq, Syria, Iran, Sudan, Libya, Somalia, or Yemen had their visas canceled, reversed course on Saturday and said they could travel to the U.S. if they had a valid visa. The department on Saturday advised refugee aid agencies that refugees set to travel before Trump signed his order will now be allowed into the United States. A State Department official said in an email obtained by the Associated Press that the government was focusing on booking refugee travel through February 17th and working to have arrivals resume as soon as Monday. The Homeland Security Department no longer was directing airlines to prevent visa holders affected by Trump's order from boarding U.S.-bound planes. The agency said it had suspended any and all actions related to putting in place Trump's order, which the White House argued was intended to protect the homeland. The Justice Department was expected to ask the Ninth Circuit to set aside Robart's ruling so the ban could go back into effect. Trump made clear what he thought of Robart's action. The opinion of this so-called judge, which essentially takes law enforcement away from our country, is ridiculous and will be overturned, Trump tweeted. When a country is no longer able to say who can and who cannot come in and out, especially for reasons of safety and security, big trouble. Senator Patrick Leahy, a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, criticized Trump for attempting to bully and disparage yet another federal judge and said he seemed intent on precipitating a constitutional crisis. Trump's rhetoric could also put government lawyers defending his order in a tough spot. Either they have to defend the statements that Judge Robart is a so-called judge, which you can't do, or they have to distance themselves from the president, who is their boss, said University of Pittsburgh law professor Arthur Hellman. With legal challenges pending, two prominent Middle East air carriers announced they would resume carrying passengers from the seven different affected countries, Qatar Airways and Etihad Airways, national carrier of the United Arab Emirates, said U.S.-bound travelers from those countries with valid visas would be allowed to board. In Egypt, Cairo Airport and airline officials said they have received instructions from the U.S. Customs and Border Protection to suspend President Trump's executive order. Government-backed Qatar Airways is one of the few Mideast airlines operating direct daily flights to multiple American cities. Its U.S. destinations from its Doha hub include New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, Miami, and Washington. At New York's John F. Kennedy International Airport, volunteer lawyer Rene Paradis said most of the flights involving passengers from the affected countries were to arrive later Saturday. Anybody who comes here on a visa is supposed to be allowed in. So we would anticipate that someone who's in the air would be able to land and enter, she said. Of course, as with everything this week, it remains to be seen what happens on the ground. The executive order has caused chaos within the government and the courts. Trump fired Sally Yates, an Obama administration holdover who was serving as acting attorney general, after she said the Justice Department would not enforce it. In Washington on Saturday, demonstrators chanting, "No hate, no fear, refugees are welcome here," walked from the White House down Pennsylvania Avenue. Hearings have also been held in court challenges nationwide. In arguments to the court, Washington State and Minnesota said the temporary ban and the global suspension of the U.S. refugee program harmed residents and effectively mandated discrimination. Federal attorneys had argued that Congress gave the president authority to make decisions on national security and immigrant entry. But in his written order Friday, Robart said it's not the court's job to create policy or judge the wisdom of any particular policy promoted by the other two branches, but rather to make sure that an action taken by the government comports with our country's laws. This article posted by Eric Tucker.
How to Watch Super Bowl 2017 Online for Free by Matt Bemmer. The entire 2016-2017 NFL season has come down to this one game. The New England Patriots will square off against the Atlanta Falcons in Houston for Super Bowl 51. There are plenty of ways to live stream all the action for free online. Commercials and Lady Gaga's halftime show too, even without cable. Here's how. If you have a TV, it won't be difficult for cord cutters to catch the big game if they have a digital antenna. And honestly, that's probably the best way to watch any major live event, even if you don't have cable. If you still don't have a digital antenna, you can snag one for a relative bargain. We recommend the Mohu Leaf, but if you want other options, check out our recommendation or wire cutters. If you don't have a TV, sorry, an antenna won't help if you don't have a TV. There's some good news, though. You can stream this year's Super Bowl on Fox Sports Go from your laptop, phone, or other device. The bad news? You'll need a cable subscription. If you're a Verizon customer, you may want to check out the NFL mobile app. It'll let you watch the Super Bowl on your phone for free. It's a really cool perk that you could have been using all season. Verizon won't even charge you data if you're not streaming on Wi-Fi. The app won't let you cast or airplay the stream on a TV, so keep that in mind if you're watching with others. One last option, you can watch the Super Bowl on NFL Game Pass, but you won't be able to watch live. The game will be available on the service after midnight. If you don't like any of those options, all right, you could just listen to the game for free on AM/FM wavelengths or snag an invite to a friend's party. Good luck! Protesters at historic Stonewall Inn show LGBT solidarity with immigrants and refugees. By Katie Riley. Protesters gathered at New York City's historic Stonewall Inn on Saturday to show solidarity with immigrants and refugees affected by President Donald Trump's immigration ban. A federal judge on Friday temporarily blocked Trump's executive order barring people from seven majority Muslim countries from entering the U.S., a decision that earned Trump's ire. People at the protest on Saturday waved rainbow flags, sang songs, and held signs challenging Trump's policies. The protest also followed speculation this week that Trump would sign an executive order rolling back LGBT protections. Instead, on Monday, Trump said he would leave in place workplace protections for LGBT people that were instituted under former President Barack Obama. Don't give up on your fitness resolution by Stacey Griffith. January came to a close. How did you do? Did you stick to your dry January goals? Did you give up dairy for the month? Did you work out like you said you would? Well, even if you didn't, I have good news for you. It's not too late to start. Let Shreduary begin. If you did stick to your plan of giving up drinking wine during the first month of 2017, chances are you're noticing that it's much easier to fit into your favorite pair of jeans now, and all of your best jackets actually have room to breathe. Nothing feels better than looking good in your clothes, right? After all, Americans spend an astonishing amount on clothing every year. We better look good. February is the month in which the real transformation begins. I've seen it happen over the last 3 decades in my fitness career. February is the month when results begin to take form. Your arms start to show some definition. Your two top abdominal rows start to pop, and the area just below your waistline begins to cinch just a bit closer to your spine without your having to suck it in. You're getting to know that feeling you get when you make healthy choices all day long. You go for the workout, you drink water all day, you shower off, you go to bed early, then after 8 hours of sleep, that 6:30 a.m. alarm clock goes off and you actually aren't annoyed that you have to get up. You're ready for the day to begin again with so much more energy than before. Everything is better when you feel this good on the inside. But what if you didn't do so great in January? Well, here's what you can do. Regroup. Get in touch with a friend who's always exercising and ask if you can join her for her February workouts. Asking for help is okay, and it'll make you feel accountable. Look at your schedule and rearrange some things so that you can actually show up for those plans that involve moving fast. Purge your fridge of any unwanted food choices that aren't good for you, like leftover cake from that party, cookies you don't need, and ice cream in the freezer. Then restock your kitchen with healthy choices, like celery sticks, cucumber slices, blueberries, raspberries, red apples, and green grapes. Pick up the Piper Protocol, the insider's secret to weight loss and internal fitness by Tracy Piper. It is a true guide to the human machine and will give you just about every single option there is to eat healthy this month. Exercise 5 to 7 days of the week for 30 to 60 minutes each session. Sleep 7 to 9 hours each night. Drink 5 one-pint bottles of water every day. Subscribe to the Motto newsletter for advice worth sharing. Watch your extra body fat drip off. The diet you choose to follow will be a huge component of your success. Consult a nutritionist, even one who's online. There's so much help on the web, it's insane and free. Just make sure that if you have medical issues, you always consult your doctor before adding anything new to your diet or exercise regime. Happy Shreduary! Stacy Griffith is a senior master instructor at SoulCycle and the author of the upcoming book, Two Turns from Zero. Stacy's motivational coaching style combines a passion for dance, athleticism, and mind-blowing music, all set to the beat of her voice. Follow her on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Don't expect Lady Gaga's Super Bowl halftime show to be political, by Daniel Diodario. Under normal circumstances, Lady Gaga's booking as the headliner of the Super Bowl halftime show would be a bit of unambiguous good fortune for her. She was coming off a stretch of her career in which, with well-received performances at the 2015 and 2016 Oscars and 2016 Super Bowl pre-show, she'd proven herself surprisingly adept at fitting old-school showmanship into familiar frameworks. Recent halftime headliners like Coldplay, Katy Perry, Bruno Mars, and Beyoncé all used the platform to promote both their music and their respective star personae. So it's safe to assume a full-length set at America's most watched television event might help reignite public interest in Gaga's act. But the Super Bowl is hardly taking place under normal circumstances. As acceptance speeches at the Golden Globes and particularly the Screen Actors Guild Awards made clear, live television entertainment events come freighted with strange and difficult-to-meet expectations. The pace of news developments during the Trump era and the sense that protests of a scale without recent precedent are endless make it clear a substantial portion of the viewership is grappling with deep existential concerns. Even the most earnestly meant political gestures can have the tendency to seem self-serving, as when Emma Stone capped off a SAG Awards full of pro-refugee messaging by attempting, to little avail, to link her film La La Land to a legacy of Hollywood reflecting society. And yet the Super Bowl, with its stadium setting, its placement in the midst of high-profile athletics and advertising, and its 100 million-plus viewership, is the most impersonal of TV venues. Shows that have succeeded in the past have done so on the back of virtuosic musical ambition, Beyoncé, or outsized spectacle, Perry. Political messaging, as in 2011, when Will.i.am of the Black Eyed Peas addressed a verse of Where is the Love to President Obama, or in 2012, when Madonna ended her show with a call for hashtag world peace, seemed grasping at best. The only recent exception came last year, when Beyoncé transmitted a clear message by dressing her dancers in Black Panther regalia, a delicious bit of homage and provocation. But Lady Gaga is not Beyoncé. Over the years, Lady Gaga's messaging, even at its most deeply felt, has tended toward theater kid obviousness. At the Oscars last year, she paid tribute to victims of sexual assault. One of her biggest hits, Born This Way, is a tribute to the LGBT community. And yet, both of these were fairly broad and inclusive. Gaga's never quite gone for social commentary that lacks a generic uplift. She's more like erstwhile chart rival Perry than she might like to admit. Not that she'll necessarily get a chance to make a political statement this year. Following the controversy over Beyoncé's message, perceived on the political right as anti-cop, Gaga has been given a show whose organizers want to play it safe. While the NFL has denied that it explicitly told her to avoid political subjects, its spokesperson Natalie Ravitz's statement speaks for itself. Everyone we work with understands this is a moment for families across America and the world to come together for a great experience. Lady Gaga understands that, and we know she will deliver an incredible performance yet again. It's forecast to be a warm night in Houston. Where'd this chill come from? The singer went on to do a Fox Sports interview wearing an NFL t-shirt and announced, "I really respect the athletes." This is not the firebrand her fans have been waiting for. Gaga has said little about the booking, although she's expressed a desire to put together the best show for the football fans, the ones that are watching at home. She also announced a partnership with luxury brand Tiffany that is to include an ad during the big game. This isn't exactly the preamble of someone planning subversion. That tends to mix poorly with commercial synergy. The argument goes that it's an artist's duty to speak out, and Gaga, who campaigned for Hillary Clinton, released a rare explicitly political song about the killing of Trayvon Martin on her last album and protested outside Trump Tower after Trump's win, has not lately been shy. But she's running up against various other duties, including the one she owes a broadcast that doesn't grant unfettered creative control. She's historically been willing to bend pop's rules, but not to outright break them. Her ability to squeeze herself into anything from a charmingly schmaltzy Julie Andrews tribute to a country album will likely serve her well once again Sunday night. At the year's biggest party, she'll probably be the perfect guest, bringing just enough heat to keep us talking until the third quarter begins. Anyone looking for a conversation to last into Monday can look elsewhere. President Trump attacks what he calls ridiculous ruling temporarily blocking immigration ban. By Katie Riley. President Donald Trump on Saturday morning lashed out at a court ruling that temporarily blocked his executive order on immigration, which barred people from seven Muslim-majority countries from entering the U.S. When a country is no longer able to say who can and who cannot come in and out, especially for reasons of safety and security, big trouble, Trump said in a tweet. Interesting that certain Middle Eastern countries agree with the ban. They know if certain people are allowed in, it's death and destruction.
U.S. District Judge James Robart in Seattle temporarily blocked Trump's immigration order on Friday night, ruling that the state of Washington had met its burden in demonstrating immediate and irreparable injury. The ruling, which applies nationwide, will temporarily allow visa holders from the seven affected countries to enter the U.S. The opinion of this so-called judge, which essentially takes law enforcement away from our country, is ridiculous and will be overturned, Trump said in another tweet, specifically targeting Robart, who was appointed by former President George W. Bush in 2003. Trump's executive order, which sparked immediate backlash, met legal challenges in several states in the past week, but Robart's ruling on Friday was the most far-reaching. Vice President Mike Pence says Neil Gorsuch will join Supreme Court one way or the other. By Darlene Superville for the Associated Press. Palm Beach, Florida. Vice President Mike Pence pledged Saturday that Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch will join the nation's highest court one way or the other. Pence made the pledge during a speech in Philadelphia to the Federalist Society, a conservative legal group. His remarks echoed President Donald Trump's comments from earlier in the week, in which the president urged Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to go nuclear and scrap longstanding rules requiring 60 votes if Democrats move to block Gorsuch. At least one Democratic senator has vowed to block Gorsuch's nomination as payback for McConnell's decision to wait until after the November 8th election to fill the opening created by the February 2016 death of Justice Antonin Scalia. The Senate held no hearings or votes on the Supreme Court candidate that President Barack Obama put forward. Trump on Tuesday announced Gorsuch, 49, a judge on the Denver-based 10th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, as his choice to succeed the conservative Scalia. Pence said Gorsuch had already met with 10 senators from both political parties and is willing to meet with all 100 senators. The vice president said a candidate to become an associate justice on the nation's highest court had never faced a successful filibuster, and Judge Neil Gorsuch should not be the first. Rest assured, we will work with the Senate leadership to ensure that Judge Gorsuch gets an up or down vote on the Senate floor, one way or the other, Pence said. This seat does not belong to any party or any ideology or any interest group. This seat on the Supreme Court belongs to the American people, and the American people deserve a vote on the floor of the United States Senate. Pence said the Senate had voted unanimously to confirm Gorsuch to his current post, and that nearly a third of the senators who voted back then remain in the Senate. The Senate's vote on Gorsuch in 2006 was by unanimous consent or voice vote. It was not a recorded vote.
One out of every four workers with a bachelor's degree is overqualified for their jobs, according to a new study. That may sound high, and it's a bummer for the workers who aren't maximizing their earning potential. But this overqualification rate is significantly lower than the results of previous studies, which estimated that as many as 48% of bachelor degree holders were overqualified for their jobs. The researcher of the new analysis, labor economist Stephen Rose, wrote the study for the left-leaning Urban Institute. He says he was inspired to tackle the subject after pondering the disconnect between various reports exploring whether college is worth the money, with some finding that a four-year degree absolutely pays off and others indicating it's not always a great value. In surveys, recent graduates overwhelmingly rated their college experience as worthwhile. And much research shows that the pay gap between those with and without college degrees has expanded. Yet other studies suggest that it's harder today for recent grads to find good jobs. What gives, Rose wondered. If it's a good thing to have a bachelor's degree, you can't also be arguing that bachelor degree holders aren't doing well, he says. So he developed a new methodology to determine what qualified as a good job for a worker with a college degree. Using a list of roughly 400 jobs, he focused on those that had a rate of bachelor degree holders higher than the population at large. It was these jobs that he deemed a good fit for a worker with a bachelor's degree. He also looked at earnings and included any job in which the salary was near or above the median for all college-educated workers. He evaluated males and females separately because of their different average earnings. The bad news is that while only a minority of college graduates appear to be overqualified for their jobs nowadays, there is a bigger penalty today for those who are doing work that's beneath them. Workers who were in poor-fit jobs in 1980 earned 35% less than their peers in good-fit jobs. By 2000, overqualified workers earned 41% less than their counterparts in jobs that suited them. And by 2014, that gap had grown to 48% for female workers and 50% for male workers. For men, the jobs with the highest rate of overqualification in 2014 included retail salesperson, customer service reps, and food service managers. For women, they were secretaries and office support workers, customer service reps, and teacher assistants. The study found that there is some evidence to back up claims that recent graduates today have it harder than graduates who entered the workforce before the Great Recession. The overqualification rate dropped between 1980 and 2000, but it bounced back up in 2014, following the 2008 financial crisis, and that increase hit younger workers the hardest. Rose's research also shows that no matter how the economy is faring, the overqualification rate is disproportionately high for workers who are just out of college and in their early 20s. By the time workers reach their late 20s, the rate drops significantly. In other words, working your way into a good job after college has long been part of the reality of launching one's career. Older generations tend to look back on these difficulties with rose-colored glasses, however. People glorify the past, Rose says. They have nostalgia. The study also found overqualification rates varied based on race. In 2014, the overqualification rates of college-educated African Americans and Hispanics were 7 and 10 percentage points higher, respectively, than the rate for white college-educated workers. Rose says his study may be especially helpful in understanding rising income inequality. Between 1980 and 2014, the earnings of college-educated workers increased at a much faster pace than those with less education, regardless of whether they were overqualified for their job. For example, in 1980, men in jobs dubbed a good fit for bachelor degrees had median salaries of $45,000 for those with college degrees and $42,000 among those without four-year college degrees. Fast forward to 2014, and that gap balloons. Workers with less than a bachelor's degree earned $50,000 or less in such jobs. Those with college degrees, however, earned a median $70,000. The same pattern held for female workers. This article posted by Caitlin Mulher.
5 times President Trump probably tweeted what he just saw on TV. By Mahita Gajanan. President Trump likes to watch cable news, and he likes to tweet. Often he tweets about what he saw on cable news, and some of those tweets may end up becoming White House policy. Trump has been clear about his TV habit. The president begins and ends each day by tuning into cable news and does not read books, according to the New York Times. During his campaign for the presidency, Trump told NBC's Chuck Todd he even gets military advice from the news. Quote, "I watch the shows," he said at the time. At least 5 times since he took office on January 20th, Trump has tweeted about policy ideas and thoughts that seem directly related to news that was being shown on channels such as Fox News. The White House didn't respond to a request for comment. On Thursday morning, Trump threatened to pull federal funding from the University of California at Berkeley after violent protest over a conservative speaker, Milo Yiannopoulos. His tweet appeared to be based on the discussions from Fox and Friends that morning, in which host Todd Starnes called for Trump to block federal funding from universities that aim to silence conservative voices. Quote, "Free speech for all or no federal money," he said. About a half hour later, Trump tweeted, "If UC Berkeley does not allow free speech and practices violence on innocent people with a different point of view, no federal funds." This follows a pattern set well before he took office. In November, he sparked controversy as president-elect after tweeting, quote, "There must be consequences," end quote, for those who burn American flags. About a half an hour after Fox and Friends aired a segment about Hampshire College removing the flag from its campus after it was burned in protest over Trump. During the first week of his presidency, Trump echoed what he saw on TV four times, beginning with a demand that the city of Chicago solve its carnage problem, or he would send in the feds. The Huffington Post, Michael Calderon, pointed out that Trump's tweet, sent January 24th, listed Chicago crime statistics shared on Fox's The O'Reilly Factor just an hour before. 2 days later, Trump said it was terrible that ungrateful traitor Chelsea Manning called former President Obama a weak leader in a column in The Guardian. CNN's Brian Stelter noted that just 14 minutes earlier, Fox News had used the same words to describe Manning, whose 35-year prison sentence for leaking government documents to WikiLeaks was commuted by Obama last month. Two tweets from Trump about voter fraud followed different television segments about the issue, something he has seized upon, claiming without proof that millions of people voted illegally in the 2016 election. The first, posted January 25th at 7:10 a.m., announced Trump's plan for a major investigation into voter fraud and came just as a Today Show segment questioning why he had not called for an investigation concluded. The Washington Post reported that the White House said an investigation into voter fraud had been under discussion for weeks, but prior to the Today Show episode and Trump's tweets, officials have maintained they are not yet investigating. Then, on January 27th, Trump tweeted about Greg Phillips, a Texas man who has repeatedly claimed, without any concrete evidence, that 3 million votes were cast by non-citizens. The note of encouragement from Trump came about 45 minutes after CNN interviewed Phillips about his unfounded claims that 3 million votes were cast illegally. Phillips' accusation was debunked by several independent experts and election officials from both the Republican and Democrat parties. Trump, however, has continued to stand by his claim.
A federal judge has temporarily blocked President Trump's travel ban nationwide. By the Associated Press, Seattle. A U.S. judge on Friday temporarily blocked President Donald Trump's ban on people from seven predominantly Muslim countries after Washington State and Minnesota urged a nationwide hold on the executive order that has launched legal battles across the country. U.S. District Judge James Robart in Seattle ruled against government lawyers' claims that the states did not have the standing to challenge Trump's order and said they showed their case was likely to succeed. The state has met its burden in demonstrating immediate and irreparable injury, Robart said. Trump's order last week sparked protests nationwide and confusion at airports as some travelers were detained. The White House has argued that it will make the country safer. Washington became the first state to sue, with Attorney General Bob Ferguson saying the order was causing significant harm to residents and effectively mandates discrimination. Minnesota joined the suit this week. The two states won a temporary restraining order while the court considers the lawsuit, which says key sections of Trump's order are illegal and unconstitutional. Court challenges have been filed nationwide from states and advocacy groups, with some other hearings also held Friday. Washington has a profound interest in protecting its residents from the harms caused by the irrational discrimination embodied in the order, Ferguson said in a brief. Federal attorneys had argued that Congress gave the president authority to make decisions on national security and admitting immigrants. The lawsuit says Trump campaigned on a promise to ban Muslims from coming to the U.S. and kept up that rhetoric while defending the travel ban. Lawyers pointed to dozens of exhibits of speeches and statements Trump has made. The executive order effectively mandates that the states engage in discrimination based on national origin and/or religion, thereby rescinding the state's historic protection of civil rights and religious freedom, the complaint said, calling it a violation of the U.S. Constitution. The lawsuit ultimately seeks to permanently block parts of the executive order that suspend immigration from the seven Muslim-majority countries, put the U.S. refugee admissions program on hold, and halt entry of Syrian refugees. Ferguson said the order is causing significant harm to Washington residents, businesses, and its education system. It will reduce tax revenue and impose significant costs on state agencies, as well as make it impossible for some state employees and students to travel, he said. Washington-based businesses like Amazon, Expedia, and Microsoft support the state's efforts to stop the order. They say it's hurting their operations, too. How Trump's presidency could become a dividing line in the Middle East, by Jared Malzin in Cairo. Tens of thousands of visas were revoked last week by President Donald Trump's executive order that bans the citizens of seven Muslim-majority nations from entering the U.S. The revelation illustrates the scale of the disruption caused by Trump's decree, which he signed an executive order on January 27th. The initial disclosure came in a federal court hearing in Virginia in a case challenging the revocation of the visas of a pair of Yemeni brothers who arrived at Washington's Dulles Airport on January 28th. The Justice Department initially said 100,000 visas had been revoked, but the State Department later claimed it was closer to 60,000. The admission capped a week of legal and political turmoil triggered by the imposition of a ban that could reshape the network of allegiances and historic grudges that govern the modern Middle East. Nation-states there divided roughly into two camps, those affected by the ban and those exempt. Among the first camp, outrage ensued. Iran banned U.S. citizens from entering. The Iraqi parliament called for the same. An official from Libya's U.S.-backed government accused America of racial discrimination. But elsewhere, there was a tactical silence. With their citizens unaffected by the ban, the governments of some U.S. allied states, including Saudi Arabia and Egypt, declined to comment. The United Arab Emirates defended the ban. Throughout the region, Trump's executive order seemed to foreshadow a coming season of turbulence in relations with the United States. During his campaign, Trump called for a total and complete shutdown on all Muslims entering the United States. Here, in the first week of Trump's administration, was a policy that followed through on his campaign rhetoric, apparently with little regard for the geopolitical fallout. The Americans don't get to act in a vacuum, and when they do act, they will often trigger responses from other political leaders who have their own political base. And I don't think they thought about that at all with respect to Iraq and Iran. My guess is they would say, "We don't care," says Robert S. Ford, a former U.S. ambassador to Syria and a career diplomat with years of experience in the Middle East. U.S. allies in the region now face a choice of acquiescing to a policy that appears to indiscriminately target citizens of other Arab and Muslim states, or rattle relations with the new U.S. administration by expressing reservations about the ban. Few seem likely to take the latter path. Among states not included in the ban, only Qatar voiced criticism of the new policy. Asked about the ban, Egypt's former ambassador to the U.S., Abdel Rouf Al-Ridi, tells Time, "Is Egypt supposed to say, to comment on anything happening in the United States?" Trump spoke on Sunday with Saudi King Salman, but a Saudi readout of the call made no reference to the ban. In Abu Dhabi on Wednesday, the United Arab Emirates Foreign Minister Abdullah bin Zayed Al Nahyan voiced support for Trump's policy, saying the executive order is not directed at a certain religion. Israel's right-wing government remained silent. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu tweeted in support of Trump's plan to build a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border, but Israel's President Reuven Rivlin later apologized to his Mexican counterpart for that statement. There was far more dissent within the U.S. than in the Middle East. The executive order enacted on January 27th created days of chaos at America's international airports as customs and border officials struggled to interpret the order. The White House initially declared that the order also applied to permanent legal residents of the United States, green card holders, before reversing that position 2 days later. As a policy, the order mirrored Trump's personal style, abrupt, unpredictable, and sometimes inscrutable. He's too erratic. It's one of the things that sets off everybody in the world, that he just says stuff. He issues policy, this crazy Muslim ban thing, and nobody knows quite what it means, so they're scrambling, says H.A. Hellyer, a senior non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council and the Royal United Services Institute in London. Imagine you're sitting in one of these foreign ministries. Is there a difference between real Donald Trump tweeting and POTUS tweeting? Is there a difference policy-wise? That's how some people are going to look at it, he adds. If the new policy presented a challenge for America's allies in the Middle East, it also gave an opening to its opponents. In Iraq, the ban undermines the standing of Iraq's U.S. allied government, handing a political opportunity to pro-Iranian rivals. The Iraqi parliament called for the government to retaliate by banning Americans, a move that would create a fiasco for more than 5,000 U.S. military personnel who are in the country helping Iraqi forces fight ISIS. In Iran, the order strengthens hardliners over officials who favor compromise and negotiation with the U.S. Moreover, experts also say the ban hands rhetorical ammunition to the jihadi propagandists of the Islamic State, who could use Trump's policy in recruiting. There are fears the order will set the tone of the White House's approach to the Muslim world over the next 4 years. Certainly, there's a history of hostility to Islam. Stephen Bannon, the White House's influential chief strategist, has in the past called Islam a dark religion. National Security Advisor Michael Flynn once said that fear of Muslims is rational. I think it reflects a deeply held dislike of Islam among Trump and his top advisors, and I think the evidence for that interpretation is now overwhelming, says Shadi Hamid, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington. We know what people like Stephen Bannon and Michael Flynn have said explicitly about not just disliking extremism or Islamism, but Islam as a religion and seeing Islam as a civilizational and ideological threat. Hamid says that Trump's policies are likely to worsen America's image in the Middle East and the broader Muslim world. When America is literally closing its borders to large numbers of people and promising to do more of that in the coming 4 years, how long will that perception last? Can the damage be undone if someone else is elected in 4 years? I don't know, but I assume that 4 years of this will do lasting damage on how America is perceived. As the week wore on, the Trump administration gave more hints about its approach, signaling it would take a far harder line on Iran. On Wednesday, Flynn declared that Iran was on notice following an attack on a Saudi naval vessel, an assault blamed on Iranian-allied Houthi rebels. Further raising tensions on Friday, the Treasury Department announced new sanctions on 25 Iranian people and companies. A consequential week could signal the shape of Trump's Middle East policy, driving a wedge yet further into the reigning split between Sunni Saudi Arabia and Shiite Iran. Others in the region will find it increasingly difficult to straddle the gap. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.